They'll do something.
Like what?
Asks Lisbeth.
Sign a second unwind order? You only need one.
At 7:15, the sun clears the mountains, heralding another scorcher, and the comm bomb begins to roast. They manage to scrounge up a few water bottles, but not enough for 15 kids who are already beginning to sweat out more than there is to take in. By 8 o'clock, the temperature hits 100, and Hayden knows this can't last. So he comes back to his favorite question, but this time it isn't rhetorical.
I want you all to listen to me and think about your answer to this,
he tells them. He waits until he's sure he has all their attention, then says,
Would you rather die, or would you rather be unwound?
They all look to one another. Some put their heads in their hands. Some sob dry tears because they're too dehydrated to cry. Hayden silently counts to 20, asks the question again, then waits for the answers. Esme, their best password-cracking hacker, is the first to break through the firewall of silence.
Die,
she says.
No question.
And Nassim says,
Die.
And Lisbeth says,
Die.
And the answers start to come faster.
Die.
Die.
Die. Everyone answers, and not a single one of them chooses unwinding.
Even if there is such a thing as living in a divided state,
Esme says,
if we get unwound, the juvies win. We can't let them win.
And so, as the temperature soars past 110 degrees, Hayden leans back against the bulkhead and does something he hasn't done since he was little. He says the Lord's Prayer. Funny how some things you never forget.
Our Father, who art in heaven.
Tad and several others are quick to join in.
Hallowed be thy name.
Nazim begins to recite an Islamic prayer, and Lisbeth covers her eyes, chanting the Shema in Hebrew. Death, as they say, doesn't just make all the world kin. It makes all religions one.
Do you think they'll just let us die?
Tad asks.
Won't they try to save us?
Hayden doesn't want to answer him, because he knows the answer is no. From the juvies' point of view, if they die, all they lose are kids no one wanted anyway. All they lose are parts.
With the news vans out there,
suggests Lisbeth.
Maybe our deaths will stand for something. People will remember that we chose death over unwinding.
Maybe,
Hayden says.
That's a good thought, Lisbeth. Hold on to it.
It's 115 degrees, 8:40 a.m. Hayden's finding it harder and harder to breathe, and he realizes the heat might not get them at all. It might be the lack of oxygen. He wonders which is lower on the list of bad ways to die.
I don't feel so good,
says a girl across from him. Hayden knew her name 5 minutes ago, but he can't think clearly enough to remember it. He knows it's only minutes now. Beside him, Tad, his eyes half open, begins babbling. Something about a vacation, sandy beaches, swimming pools.
Daddy lost the passports. Oh, no, Mommy's gonna be mad.
Hayden puts his arm around him and holds him like a little brother.
No passports,
Tad says.
No passports. Can't get back home.
Don't even try, Tad,
Hayden says.
Wherever you are, stay there. Sounds like the place to be.
Soon Hayden feels his eyesight starting to black out, and he goes places too. A house he lived in as a kid before his parents started fighting. Riding his bike up a jump ramp he can't handle, and breaking his arm in the fall.
What were you thinking, son?
A fight his parents had over custody in the heat of their divorce.
You'll have him all right. You'll have him over my dead body.
And Hayden just laughing and laughing. Because it's his only defense against the prospect of his family collapsing around him. And then overhearing their decision to unwind him, rather than allowing the other to have custody. Not so much a decision, but an impasse.
Fine.
Fine.
If that's the way you want it.
If that's the way you want it.
Don't put this on me.
They signed the unwind order just to spite each other. but laugh, laugh, laugh. Hayden, because if you ever stop laughing, it might just tear you apart worse than a chop shop. Now he's far away, floating in the clouds, playing Scrabble with the Dalai Lama. But wouldn't you know it, all the tiles are in Tibetan. Then for a moment his vision clears, and he comes back to the here and now. He's lucid enough to realize he's in the comm bomb where the temperature is too hot to imagine. He looks around him. The kids are awake, but barely. They slump in corners. They lie on the ground.
You were talking about stuff,
someone says weakly.
Keep talking, Hayden. We liked it.
Then Esme reaches over and touches Tad on the neck, feeling his pulse. His eyes are still half open, but he's no longer babbling about tropical beaches.
Tad's dead, Hayden.
Hayden closes his eyes. Once one goes, he knows the rest of them won't be far behind. He looks at the machine gun next to him. It's heavy. It's loaded. He doesn't even know if he can lift it anymore, but he does. And although he's never used it, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out. There's a safety, easily removed. There's a trigger. He looks at the suffering kids around him, wondering where machine gun fire falls on the list of bad ways to die. Certainly a quick death is better than a slow one. He considers his options a moment more, then says,
I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry I failed you. But I can't do this.
Then he turns the machine gun toward the cockpit and blasts out the windshield, flooding the comm bomb with cool, fresh air. 82. Connor. He wakes up in a comfortable bed, in a comfortable room, with a computer, a late-model TV, and sports posters all over the walls. He's groggy enough to think he actually might be in heaven, but nauseous enough to know he's not.
I know you're pissed at me, Connor, but I had to do it.
He turns to see Lev sitting in the corner, in a chair that's painted with footballs and soccer balls and tennis balls to match the decor of the room.
Where are we? We're in Sunset Ridge Homes, model number 3, the Bahaman.
You brought me to a model home?
I figured we both deserved comfortable beds, at least for one night. It's a trick I learned from my days on the streets. Security patrols are looking for thieves, not squatters. They roll past, but never go into model homes unless they see or hear something suspicious. So as long as you don't snore too loud, you're fine.
Then he adds,
Of course, we gotta be out by 10. That's when they open. I stayed too late at a model once and nearly scared a realtor to death.
Connor pulls himself to the edge of the bed. On TV is a news report, aftermath and analysis of the AWOL raid at the airplane graveyard.
It's been on the news since last night,
Lev tells him.
Not enough to preempt the infomercials and stuff, but at least the juvies aren't hiding it.
Why would they hide it?
Connor says.
It's their stinking moment of glory.
On TV, a spokesperson for the Juvenile Authority announces that the count of AWOLs killed was 33. The number brought in alive is 467.
With so many, we'll have to divvy them out to various harvest camps,
the man says, not even realizing the irony in using the word divvy. Connor closes his eyes, which makes them burn. 33 dead, 467 caught. If Starkey got away with about 150, that leaves maybe 65 who managed to escape on foot. Not nearly enough.
You shouldn't have taken me, Lev.
Why? Would you rather be a trophy to go along with their collection of unwinds? If they find out that the Akron AWOL is alive, they'll crucify you. Trust me, that's one thing I know about.
The captain is supposed to go down with the ship.
Unless the first mate knocks him out and throws him in a lifeboat.
Connor just glares at him.
Fine,
says Lev.
You want to punch me?
Connor chuckles at that and looks at his right arm.
Careful what you ask for, Lev. I pack quite a punch these days.
Then he shows Lev the tattoo.
Yeah, I noticed that. There must be a story there. I mean, you hated Roland, right? Why'd you get the same tattoo?
Now Connor laughs out loud. Hard to imagine that Lev doesn't even know, but then how could he? Yeah, there's a story, he says. Remind me to tell you about it someday. On screen, they cut live to the graveyard, where an unfolding drama is taking place. One last batch of AWOLs has held off the juvies by holding up inside an old World War II bomber.
It's the comm bomb. Hayden held them off all night.
For Connor, it's almost like victory. The comm bomb hatch opens, and Hayden comes out, carrying a limp kid in his arms. He's followed by a bunch of other kids, none of them in good shape. The juvies move in, and so do the media.
We're witnessing the capture of the final AWOL unwinds.
The reporters don't get close enough to stick microphones in Hayden's face, but they don't have to. In spite of the juvie's attempt to spirit him into the transport van, he shouts loud enough for everyone to hear.
We are not just AWOLs! We are not just parts! We are whole human beings! And history will look back on these times in shame!
They shove him and the other kids into the van, but before they slam the door, Hayden shouts,
To the new teen uprising!
Then the van carries them away.
Way to go, Hayden, says Connor. Way to go.
The news briefly reports on the plane that got away, but as that's an embarrassment to the juvies, not much is said. At first, they had forced a plane to land in Dallas, thinking it was the AWOL Dreamliner, but it turned out to be a passenger flight from Mexico City. There have been unconfirmed reports of a plane going down in a California lake, but nothing further is said. Connor suspects the plane that went down is the Dreamliner, and as much as he'd like to see Starkey at the bottom of a lake, Connor hopes the stork survived the crash. That would be more AWOLs who got away from the juvies. Damn Starkey. He brought the juvies down on them, then took half the weapons, hijacked their only means of escape, and left everyone else high and dry. And yet as much as Connor wants to blame it all on Starkey, he can't help but feel the brunt of the blame. He was the one who trusted Starkey to begin with, allowing him to amass power among the storks. When it's clear that the news has moved on to other subjects, weather woes and celebrities behaving badly, Connor turns off the TV.
9:30. Almost time to move on. Actually, there's one more thing I want to show you before we go.
Lev goes to the room's computer and pulls up, of all things, a website for hot tubs. Sorry, Lev, I'm not in the market for a jacuzzi. Lev is stymied for a moment until Connor notices the mistake.
YouTube has an E at the end.
Duh,
Lev types it over. I was never good at keyboarding.
He tries again, and this time gets it right. Lev clicks on a video, and Connor's heart just about stops. It's yet another news interview with Risa.
I don't want to see it.
Connor reaches to turn it off, but Lev grasps his wrist.
Yes, you do.
And although the last thing Connor wants to see is another sales pitch for unwinding, he gives in, bracing himself for whatever he's about to see. He can tell right away from the look on Reese's face that she has a single-minded determination she didn't have in the other interview he saw. He watches in amazement as, in less than 2 minutes, she blasts proactive citizenry, the juvies, and unwinding so completely there's no doubt which side she's on. The show's anchorman is left scrambling to pick up the pieces.
They were blackmailing her.
Connor feels his eyes get moist. He knew there had to be an explanation, but he had become so jaded against everyone and everything he was willing to believe that Risa had chosen to heal herself at everyone else's expense. Now he's ashamed of himself for thinking that.
Proactive citizenry has already released a statement denying it,
Lev tells him.
They claim she's the one who used them.
Yeah, right. Let's hope nobody's stupid enough to believe them.
Some people are, some aren't.
Connor looks to Lev and smiles, realizing that getting tranked kind of put a damper on their reunion.
It's good to see you, Lev.
Same here.
What's with the hair? Lev shrugs.
It's a look.
They hear a car pulling up in the sales office parking lot. Time to go.
So what do we do now?
Lev asks.
I'm kind of AWOL from the anti-divisional resistance.
The ADRs become useless. If the best they can do is send AWOLs to a holding pen for the juvies, then something's not working. Someone needs to rethink things.
Why not you?
Lev suggests. Why not us? Connor counters. Lev considers it.
Well, you're a martyr and I'm a patron saint. I can't think of anyone better. So where do we start?
It's a big question. Where do you begin to change the world? Connor thinks he may have the answer. Have you ever heard of Jansen Reinschild? 83. Nelson. Even before he comes fully to his senses, he knows something has gone terribly, terribly wrong. He opens his eyes to scorching daylight. He's lying in a ditch. His body aches. One side of his face feels as if it's on fire. He was tranked, not just once, but repeatedly, and by his own damn gun. Enough sedatives to knock him out for maybe 12 hours. It's a wonder he hasn't been eaten alive by desert scavengers, but from the pain in his left leg and bloody holes in his stolen uniform, clearly something tried. Nelson wonders how long he's been in the sun. Long enough for half his face to be swollen and throbbing from a second-degree sunburn. He had him. He had Connor Lassiter. And now he has nothing but the tattered clothes on his back. It was the tithe. How could Nelson have been so careless? He should have killed Lev when he had the chance, but out of the kindness of his heart he had let the boy live. And here is the result of kindness. The two will already be far from here, covering their tracks. His laptop held the codes of Lev's tracking nanites. Without his computer, they're useless. Nelson will not give up. He will find them. Tracking has always been his specialty, and this setback? It's nothing. It will only make him more determined, more ruthless in achieving his goal. He climbs out of the ditch and marches, weak-legged, but strong-willed, like a zombie, toward Tucson. He will catch the Akron AWOL, deliver him to Devan, and be there to witness his unwinding. But the tithe will not meet such a merciful end. When Nelson finds Lev, he will visit upon the boy such wrath it will make the very ground tremble. Of this, Nelson can be sure. Just thinking about it fills him with enough joy and purpose to propel him down the long road to Tucson and dark destinies beyond. 84. Connor.
Flagstaff doesn't look much like South Arizona, says Lev. Looks more like Denver or something.
Denver doesn't look like Denver, Connor tells him. I was there once. It doesn't have crazy mountain views like you'd think. The views here are better. After being so long in the South Arizona desert, Connor is thankful for the dramatic change in scenery. With white-capped mountains to the north and an abundance of pine trees, he knows they can't be too far from the town of Happy Jack and the Dead Harvest Camp. But he tries not to think about that. The past is the past. They've stopped at a diner on historic Route 66, and, bucking the paranoia that the past year has infused them with, they have dinner in full view of anyone who cares to notice them. No one does. Their car is a nondescript beige Honda that Connor hotwired back in Phoenix after ditching the Ford he hotwired in Tucson after ditching Nelson's van. Anyone trying to track them would be hard-pressed to keep up with their transportation switcheroos. The Rain Valley Diner boasts the best burgers in the Southwest. Connor hasn't had food this good since before his parents signed his unwind order and his life turned upside down. As far as he's concerned, the Rain Valley Diner has the best burgers in the world. With one hand, he eats his burger, and with the other, he does some information gathering on Nelson's laptop, which the parts pirate was kind enough to leave for them in his van.
Find out anything new?
Lev asks. It looks like Risa disappeared after the broadcast last night, and Proactive Citizenry wants her head. Not unwound, just her head, like on a stake.
Ew.
And Hayden's being charged with everything they can charge him with.
At least they can't unwind him.
But they can unwind everyone else who got caught. The thought of the captured holies brings Connor waves of anger, chased by sadness that threatens to wash him down into the lightless places within himself.
I should have been able to save them.
Hey, you did everything you could. And besides, they're not unwound yet,
Lev reminds him.
Maybe what we do now can still make a difference for them.
Connor closes the laptop.
Maybe, but what are we going to do now?
They sit in a long, uncomfortable silence, doing nothing but eating, because that's easier than answering the question. No plans, no destination, no idea what direction to go from here, other than away. Connor's first instinct is to find Risa, but he knows that, like himself, she'll be completely off radar. He wouldn't even know where to start looking.
I could take you to the Kavanaugh mansion,
Lev suggests.
You'd be safe there.
Safe would be nice for once, but that's not happening.
Besides, didn't you bail from there?
Yeah, well, if I come back with the one and only Akron AWOL, I think they'll forgive me.
Keep your voice down.
Connor looks around. They've chosen a corner booth that's relatively secluded, but it's not that big of a diner, and voices carry.
Maybe we ought to check out that U-tub place. Get a jacuzzi and turn into a couple of spa potatoes. We deserve some downtime.
He knows Lev is kidding, but there's something about what he said that triggers a thought. It's a small thought at first, but it grows quickly. An inkling becomes a hunch, becomes an idea, becomes a revelation, and Connor flips open the laptop again, clicking and typing furiously.
What is it?
Lev asks.
Jansen Reinschild.
But you already told me he was wiped out of digital existence, so what's the point in looking?
Connor continues to ply the search engines, getting the keyboard slick with French fry grease.
You gave me an idea.
Me?
The hot tub website, the typo.
Are you going to make fun of my keyboarding skills again?
No. You got to have skills to make fun of them,
Connor tells him.
Anyway, Hayden figured there's a code-eating worm on the net that chewed up every reference to Jansen Reinschild, but it's only looking for his name spelled correctly, so I'm inputting every possible misspelling of his name.
Lev smiles.
Leave it to you to turn someone else's screw-up into gold.
Connor orders a second burger and spends 20 minutes misspelling the name. By the last bite of the burger, he's ready to give up hope. Then suddenly, there's a glint of that gold Lev was talking about, and it turns out to be the mother lode.
Lev, take a look at this.
Lev comes around to his side of the booth, and they look at a news article dated more than 30 years ago. The article is from a small local paper somewhere in Montana, where Reinschild once lived. Apparently they kept tabs on one of their favorite sons, but consistently misspelled his name as Reinschild, R-E-I-G-N-C-H-I-L-D. Connor and Lev read the article in stunned disbelief. Reinschild, a research scientist and inventor, was important enough to make quite a name for himself. Until that name got erased like a shunned pharaoh from an Egyptian obelisk.
My God,
Connor says.
This guy pioneered neural bonding and regeneration, the very technology that made unwinding possible. Without Reinschild, transplants and grafting would be back in the Stone Age. So he was the monster who started this.
No, this was right at the beginning of the war, before anyone even thought of unwinding.
Connor plays a video embedded in the article, and they watch an interview with Reinschild, a middle-aged man with glasses and thinning hair, two clear signs that it was before unwinding.
We can't even begin to know the uses of this technology,
Reinschild says with an excitement much more youthful than he looks.
Imagine a world where loved ones who die young don't really die, because every part of them can be donated to ease someone else's suffering. It's one thing to be an organ donor, and another to know that every single part of you will save someone else's life. That's a world I want to live in.
Connor shivers, for the first time noticing the air-conditioned chill of the diner. The world Reinschild described is a world Connor would want to live in, too. But that's not the world they ended up with.
Of course there are going to be ethical questions,
Reinschild goes on to say.
Which is why I've started an organization to study the ethical issues inherent in this sort of medical advancement. Proactive citizenry, as I'm calling it, will be a watchdog to make sure there are no abuses of this technology. A conscience to make sure nothing goes wrong.
Connor stops the video, trying to process it all.
Holy crap! So he founded Proactive Citizenry to protect the world from what he created!
And it became the very monster he was afraid of.
Connor thinks back to something he learned in school. Oppenheimer, the man who created the first nuclear bomb, turned against it in the end and became the bomb's greatest opponent. What if Rothschild was the same, speaking out against unwinding, then was silenced, or worse? Was silenced before he even had the chance to speak out. Not even the Admiral remembered the man, which means Rothschild was either already gone or was prevented from speaking out against the Unwind Accord. Lev reaches over and starts the video again. Just a few more seconds of Rothschild joyfully, naively waxing on about the glorious future he envisioned.
This is just the beginning. If we're able to regenerate nerve tissue, we can regenerate anything. It's just a matter of time.
The interview freezes on his smiling face, and Connor can't help but feel tremendous sorrow for this man, the secret father of unwinding, who paved a road to a place beyond hell with his good intentions.
That's pretty wild, says Lev. But how can knowing all this stop unwinding? Isn't that what you said, that finding out about this guy can change life as we know it? Or something like that. Even if everyone knew about him, it wouldn't change a thing.
Connor shakes his head in frustration.
There's gotta be something we're missing.
He scrolls down to the end of the article, where there's a picture of Rothschild and his wife in a laboratory. Apparently they worked as a team. When Connor reads the caption beneath the photo, his stomach seizes so suddenly he thinks he might lose both of his best in the Southwest burgers.
It couldn't be.
What is it?
Connor can't speak for a moment. He looks at the caption again.
His wife. Her name is Sonia.
Lev doesn't get it. And why should he? He was never in that first safe house with Connor and Risa. Sonia was the name of the old woman who ran it. Over the years, she must have rescued hundreds, maybe thousands, of AWOL unwinds. Connor enlarges the picture on the screen, and the more he looks at Mrs. Rothschild, the more certain he is. It's the same Sonia.
What was it she said to him?
We move in and out of darkness and light all of our lives. Right now, I'm pleased to be in the light.
Connor had no idea the burden of darkness she must have been carrying all these years.
I know that woman, he tells Lev, and now I know where we have to go. We're going back to Ohio.
Lev grows pale at the suggestion.
Ohio?
The thought of home brings a scorpion's nest of emotions neither one of them are ready for. But Sonia's antique shop is in Akron. If there's more to this picture, she's the only one who can give it to them. Bells above the diner's front door jingle, and a stone-faced deputy saunters in, his eyes immediately scanning the room. While Connor and Lev were absorbed by the news article, two patrol cars had pulled up out front, and officers are all over the stolen Honda.
You look like a deer in headlights,
Connor whispers to Lev.
Stop it.
I can't help it.
Lev lowers his head so his hair hangs over his face, but that looks just as conspicuous as antelope eyes. Sure enough, the deputy zeroes in on them and makes a beeline across the diner. But to Connor's surprise, their waitress gets to the table first and says,
Tommy, you just about inhaled those burgers. You keep eating like that and you'll burst out of your jeans.
Connor is a little slack-jawed as the deputy arrives, but Lev pulls out of roadkill mode and says,
Yeah, Tommy, you're such a pig. You'll get fat just like your dad.
It's in the jeans,
says the waitress, not missing a beat.
Better be careful.
The deputy turns to the waitress.
You know these boys, Carla?
Yeah, this is my nephew, Tommy, and his friend Evan.
Ethan, says Lev. You always get my name wrong.
Well, at least I knew it started with an E.
Connor nods politely to the deputy and looks at the waitress.
Your burgers are just too good, Aunt Carla. So if I get fat, it's your fault.
Satisfied, the deputy turns to Carla, concluding that Connor and Lev are somebody else's problem.
Know anything about that car out there?
He asks her. Carla looks out the window and says,
Couple of kids pulled up, maybe an hour ago. Boy and a girl. I noticed them because they looked to be in a hurry.
They come in?
No, they just ran off.
I'm not surprised. The car was stolen down in Phoenix.
Joyriders?
Maybe. Could be AWOLs. Bunch of them escaped from that old Air Force base in Tucson.
He jots her statement down in his notepad.
You remember anything else, you'd be sure to let us know.
Once the deputy is gone, Carla winks at Connor and Lev.
Well, Tommy and Ethan, your meal's on the house today.
Thank you,
Connor says.
For everything.
She winks at him.
Least I can do for my favorite nephew.
Then she reaches into her pocket and, to his amazement, puts a set of car keys in front of Connor. Rabbit's foot keychain and all.
Why don't you do me a favor and drive my car home for me today? It's out back.
Lev looks at Connor, astonished, which isn't much different from his deer in headlights look. For a moment, Connor thinks she might recognize who they are, but he realizes this is not about recognition. It's about the random kindness of a stranger.
I can't take these keys,
Connor whispers. Carla lowers her voice to match his.
Yes, you can. And anyway, you'd be doing me a favor taking that clunker off my hands. Even better, why don't you total it when you're through? 'Cause I could use the insurance money.
Connor takes the keys from the table. He doesn't even know how to say thank you for something like this. It's been a very long time since anyone has gone so far out of their way to help him.
You need to know that not everyone's your enemy,
Carla says.
Things are changing out there. People are changing. It might not be all that obvious, but it's there, and I see it every day. Why, just last week a trucker came in and was bragging all about how last year he picked up that Akron AWOL kid at a rest stop and gave him a ride. Poor guy got arrested for it, too. But still, he was bragging, because he knew it was the right thing to do.
Connor suppresses a smile. He knows the exact trucker she's talking about. Josias Aldridge, with the grafted card trick arm. Connor has to clench his jaw to keep himself from telling her all about it.
There's ordinary people out there doing extraordinary things.
Then she winks at them again.
And now you've given me the chance to be one of those extraordinary, ordinary people. So I should be the one thanking you.
Connor rubs the rabbit's foot between his fingers, hoping that his own luck has finally changed.
It's too suspicious if you don't report it as stolen.
I will,
Carla says.
Eventually.
Then she stands up and starts stacking their empty plates.
I'm telling you, change is on the way,
she says.
It's like a plump old peach, ripe and ready to drop.
Then she offers them both a warm smile before going back to waiting tables.
You take care now.
Connor and Lev take a few moments to collect their thoughts. Then they head out and around back to find a classic red Charger with some fender damage. Not exactly a show car, but no clunker either. They get in. Connor starts it, and it purrs like a waking lion. The car smells of rose air freshener, and there are middle-aged woman accessories everywhere. But that's okay. Connor doesn't mind being reminded of ordinary, extraordinary Carla. As they pull out onto the road, Lev looks over at Connor.
Ohio? Lev says. Does it really have to be Ohio?
Connor grins at him.
Yes, it does. And when we get there, the first thing I'm going to do is make you get a haircut.
Then they pull onto Route 66, heading east into a world that's ripe for saving.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Unholy, written by Neil Schusterman, narrated by Luke Daniels, producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2012 by Neil Schusterman. Production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.